activity? There is the same indefiniteness as to the nature of the activity and of what it is that is acting. Eddington goes on to point out that, despite this indefiniteness, physics can get results, because the electrons, the unknowns within the atom, are countable. 8 slithy toves, gyre and gimble in the oxygen wave, 7 in nitrogen. By admitting a few numbers, even Jabberwocky may become scientific. We can now venture on a prediction. If one of its toves escapes, oxygen will be masquerading in garb properly belonging to nitrogen. It would not be a bad reminder of the essential unknowingness of the fundamental entities of physics to translate it into Jabberwocky, provided all numbers, all metrical attributes are unchanged. It does not suffer in the least. The point which emerges is that what we are counting or measuring in physics, and that what we are experiencing in everyday life as sense data, is at root unknown, and probably unknowable. At this point, modern logical philosophy dismisses the problem and turns its attention to something else, on the assumption that the unknowable need not and cannot concern us further. It asserts that questions which have neither the physical nor the logical possibility of an answer are not real questions. But this assertion does not get rid of the common human feeling that such unknowns or unknowables as electrons, energy, existence, consciousness, or reality are in some way queer. The very fact of not being able to know them makes them all the stranger. Only a rather dry kind of mind turns away from them, a mind interested in nothing but logical structures. The more complete kind of mind, which can feel as well as think, remains to indulge the odd sense of mystery which comes from contemplating the fact that everything is, at base, something which cannot be known. Every statement which you make about this something turns out to be nonsense. And what is specially strange is that this unknowable something is also the basis of that which otherwise I know so intimately, myself. Western man has a peculiar passion for order and logic, such that for him the entire significance of life consists in putting experience into order. What is ordered is predictable, and thus a basis for safe bets. We tend to show a psychological resistance to areas of life and experience where logic, definition, and order, that is, knowledge in our sense, are inapplicable. For this type of mind, the realm of indeterminacy and Brownian movements is frankly embarrassing. And the contemplation of the fact that everything is reducible to something we cannot think about is even disquieting. There is no real reason why it should be disquieting, because our inability to know what electrons are does not seem to interfere with our capacity to predict their behavior in our own macroscopic world. The resistance is not based on some fear of an unpredictable action which the unknown may produce, although I suspect that even the most hardened logical positivist would have to admit to some odd feelings in face of an unknown called death. The resistance is rather the fundamental unwillingness of this type of mind to contemplate the limits of its power to succeed, order, and control. It feels that if there are areas of life which it cannot order, it is surely reasonable, therefore orderly, to forget them and turn to areas of life which can be ordered, so that the sense of success of the mind's own competence can be maintained. The contemplation of these intellectual limitations is, for the pure intellectual, a humiliation. But for the man who is something more than a calculator, the baffling is also the wonderful. In the face of the unknowable, he feels, with Goethe, that the highest to which man can attain is wonder. And if the prime phenomenon makes him wonder, let him be content. Nothing higher can it give him, and nothing further should he seek for behind it. Here is the limit. In the type of metaphysical or mystical experience which we are discussing, this feeling of wonder, which has all kinds of depths and subtleties, is one of two major components. The other is a feeling of liberation, the Hindu moksha, which attends the realization that an immense amount of human activity is directed to the solution of unreal and purely fantastical problems, to the attainment of goals which we do not actually desire. Speculative metaphysics, ontology, and epistemology are the intellectual aspects of fantastic problems which are basically psychological and by no means confined to persons of a philosophical or even religious turn of mind. As already indicated, the essential nature of this kind of problem is circular, the attempt to know the knower, to make fire burn fire. This is why Buddhism speaks of release, nirvana, as deliverance from the wheel, and of seeking reality as like looking for an ox when you are riding on one. The psychological basis of these circular problems becomes clear when we look into the assumptions upon which, for example, the problems of ontology are based. What premises of thought and feeling underlie men's efforts to know being, existence, or energy as objects? Clearly, one assumption is that these names refer to objects, an assumption which could not have been made if there were not beneath it the further assumption that I, the knowing subject, am somehow different from being, the supposed object. If it were perfectly clear that the question, what is being, is, in the final analysis, the same question as, what am I, the circular and futile character of the question would have been obvious from the beginning. But that it was far from clear is shown by the fact that metaphysical epistemology could ask the question, what am I, or what is that which is conscious, without recognizing a still more obvious circle? Obviously, questions of this order could be taken seriously only because of some non-logical feeling of the need for an answer. This feeling, common perhaps to most human beings, is surely the sense that I, the subject, am a unique, isolated entity. There would be no need whatsoever to wonder what I am, unless in some way I felt strange to myself. But so long as my consciousness feels strange to, cut off, and separate from its own roots, I can feel meaning in an epistemological question which has no logical sense. For I feel that consciousness is a function of I, not recognizing that I, the ego, is just another name for consciousness. The statement, I am conscious, is then a concealed tautology, saying only that consciousness is a function of consciousness. It can escape from this circularity upon the sole condition that I is taken to mean very much more than consciousness or its contents. But in the West, this is not a usual use of the word. We identify I with the conscious will and do not admit moral authority or responsibility for what we do unconsciously and unintentionally. The implication being that such acts are not our deeds, but merely events which happen within us. When I is identified with consciousness, man feels himself to be a detached, separate, and uprooted entity, acting freely in a void. This uprooted feeling is doubtless responsible for the psychological insecurity of Western man, and his passion for imposing the values of order and logic upon the whole of his experience. Yet, while it is obviously absurd to say that consciousness is a function of consciousness, there seems to be no means of knowing that of which consciousness is a function. That which knows, and which psychologists call somewhat paradoxically the unconscious, is never the object of its own knowledge. Now consciousness, the ego, feels uprooted so long as it avoids and refuses to accept the fact that it does not and cannot know its own base or ground. But when this is recognized, the consciousness feels connected, rooted, even though it does not know to what it is connected, in what it is rooted. So long as it retains delusions of self-sufficiency, omnicompetence, and individual free will, it ignores the unknown on which it rests. By the familiar law of reversed effort, this refusal of the unknown brings the feeling of insecurity, and in its train all the frustrating and impossible problems, all the vicious circles of human life, from the exalted nonsense of ontology down to the vulgar realms of power politics, where individuals play at being God. The hideous contrivances of the police, 100% safe and ordered state, for planning the planners and guarding the guards and investigating the investigators are simply the political and social equivalents of the quests of speculative metaphysics. Both alike have their psychological origin in the reluctance of consciousness, of the ego, to face its own limits and to admit that the ground and essence of the known is the unknown. It does not matter very much whether you call this unknown Brahman or blah, though the latter term usually indicates the intention to forget it and the former to keep it in mind. Keeping it in mind, the law of reversed effort works in the other direction. I realize that my very substance, that which I am, is altogether beyond grasping or knowing. It is not I, a word which suggests that it means something. It is nonsense and nothing. Which is why Mahayana Buddhism calls it Tathatha, of which a good translation might be Dada and Shunyata, the void or indeterminate. Similarly, the Vedantins say Tat Tvam Asi, that are thou, without ever giving a positive designation of what that is. The man who tries to know, to grasp himself, becomes insecure, just as one suffocates by holding one's breath. Conversely, the man who really knows that he cannot grasp himself gives up, relaxes, and is at ease. But he never really knows if he simply dismisses the problem and does not pause to wonder, to feel, and to become vividly aware of the real impossibility of self-knowledge. To the religious mentality of the modern West, this entirely negative approach to reality is almost incomprehensible, for it suggests only that the world is based on the shifting sands of nonsense and caprice. For those who equate sanity with order, this is a doctrine of pure despair. Yet little more than 500 years ago, a Catholic mystic was saying of God, "By love he may be gotten and holden, but by thought, never." And that God must be known through unknowing, through mystical ignorance. And the love of which he spoke was not emotion. It was the general state of mind which exists when a man, through the realization of its impossibility, is no longer trying to grasp himself, to order everything, and to be dictator of the universe. In our own day, logical philosophy provides the same technique of negation, telling us that in every statement in which we think we have grasped or defined or merely designated reality, we have uttered only nonsense. When the tongue tries to put itself into words, the most that may be expected is a tongue twister. For this reason, the procedures of logical philosophy will only be disquieting to those theologians and metaphysicians who imagine that their definitions of the absolute actually define anything. But it was always perfectly clear to the philosophers of Hinduism and Buddhism, and to some fewer Catholic mystics, that words such as Brahman, Tathatha, and God meant not something, but nothing. They indicated a void in the knowledge, somewhat as a window is outlined by the frame. Yet logical philosophy pursues its criticism further and says that nonsense statements and exclamations of this order do not constitute philosophy because they contribute nothing to knowledge, by which they mean they do not assist us in predicting anything and offer no directions for human conduct. That is, in part, true, though it misses the very obvious point that philosophy, wisdom, consists as much in its spaces as in its lines, in recognizing what is not and cannot be known, as in the contrary. But we must go farther than this truism. Knowledge is more than know-how, and wisdom is more than predicting and ordering. Human life becomes a fantastic vicious circle when man tries to order and control the world and himself beyond certain limits, and these negative metaphysics at least convey the positive injunction to relax this excess of effort. But beyond this, they have a positive consequence, which is still more important. They integrate logic and conscious thought with the indeterminate matrix, the nonsense, which we find at the root of all things. The assumption that the task of philosophy, as of human life, is fulfilled only in predicting and ordering, and that the nonsensical has no value, rests upon a sort of philosophical schizophrenia. If man's work is entirely to go to war on chaos with logic to determine the indeterminate, if the good is the logical and the evil the whimsical, then logic, consciousness, and the human brain is in conflict with the source of its own life and ability. We must never forget that the processes which form this brain are unconscious, and that beneath all the perceptible orders of the macroscopic world lies the indeterminate nonsense of the microscopic, the gyring and gimbling of a tobe called energy, about which we know nothing. Ex nihilo omnia fiunt. But this nothing is a very strange thing. Logical philosophy does not seem to have faced